This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. What are psychedelic drugs? If you're like me, you may have a basic idea that it's something that alters your state of mind, but aren't really sure beyond that. Well, here now to help us understand where these drugs come from and what they were originally intended for is Bruce Martin, professor of anatomy, cell biology, and physiology at Indiana University. Welcome, Bruce.
Nice to be here.
Let's start with an overview. What are psychedelic drugs versus psychoactive?
Psychoactive drugs are any drugs that affect the way you think, feel, how your brain works in terms of your mood and so forth. Psychedelic drugs are specifically a kind of drug that changes the way you perceive the world in some unique ways. So they have properties that are, there are actually just four drugs that officially are psychedelic that cause the kinds of things we think about in terms of the change of perception of the world.
And what are those four?
Those four drugs are DMT or dimethyltryptamine, LSD, lysergic acid, diethylamide, psilocybin or psilocybin, and mescaline.
When I hear the word mescaline, I think of, I feel like there's a plant or something that we eat in our salad that has that same name. Am I wrong?
It does sound like that, but this specifically is from a cactus, the San Pedro or the peyote cactus in the desert southwest of the U.S. and northwestern Mexico. And mescaline in this regard is a specific small chemical that has a very distinctive and unique action in the brain.
Out of the four, are there any that are stronger than others, or they all do their own different thing?
They all do the same thing, but LSD is far the most potent, meaning it takes the least amount of it to cause the effects. And that makes it a little more tricky to work with. So most of the studies that are coming up on psychedelics are using psilocybin because it's less potent and more easily handled.
Where did all of these substances originate from? Is it from nature? Is it somebody just happened to eat something and realized they had a reaction?
It's fascinating how different cultures have discovered these things in terms of psilocybin and in terms of mescaline. There are, in terms of DMT, there are, we might call them original or aboriginal cultures that have discovered these things in the process of centuries or millennia and have used them in various kinds of rituals typically. The one that's distinctive is LSD, which was created in a drug company laboratory by accident in the 1940s, although it has the same receptor actions, that is to say the specific effects in the brain as these other three drugs.
And you mentioned some of these have come from cultures in the past that used it. Would it be considered, do you think it's cultural appropriation for people to try to use these substances now in different ways than what they were intended for maybe in the past?
I think it's a potential concern, especially with mescaline, because the Native American church uses that specifically in their current religious ceremonies. So I think there could be a concern about that. But psilocybin, which is from these so-called magic mushrooms, is not used by any native or cultures now that I'm aware of. There's no formal recognition of it as a use by some particular culture. So it's a little easier to use that one or to use LSD, which was synthesized in a lab.
What do you think has given these products or substances, I should say, such a bad reputation?
They have a problem in the sense that they have a very unpredictable effect, and they can be used recreationally. They can be abused recreationally, and people can take them having the intention of not doing something therapeutic or helpful, but just seeing what happens. Let's have fun. So when they got out into the culture as recreational things, they became much more a problem. And that's one reason why they were made illegal and not studied for many decades.
If you have questions about psychedelics and are looking for some answers, the phone lines are open. You can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Or you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. We're speaking with Bruce Martin, professor of anatomy, cell biology, and physiology at Indiana University. Bruce, when it comes to psilocybin, you mentioned it comes from mushrooms. Can you tell us a little bit more about this? What's the makeup and... Yeah, I'm just curious, like, how it was discovered.
It's these drugs have been discovered along the way because people say, hey, look, there's effects of doing this. There's something in this plant or in this fungus that's making things happen in my brain. And then scientists go in there and look for the compound that is the active compound. And what they've found is LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, and DMT all have an action in the brain at a specific receptor, which is a docking site in the brain on brain cells, that's exactly the same. So the receptors in the brain for these four different drugs is the same, and their effects overall in the brain are the same. So once we find a substance, and you could create one from scratch today that binds those receptors in that way, we can predict what the effects will be.
What have you learned in the years of study and teaching this topic?
Well, of course, I've learned that students are fascinated by this particular topic. It's one of their favorites always. But what's come to light in recent years is the fact that these things may actually have therapeutic effects, which just a few years ago was considered to be impossible. But some really groundbreaking research at Johns Hopkins University through some researchers had the initiative to break through the ban on using these substances has shown that they have some real therapeutic potential for treating a lot of diverse illnesses, such as depression, anxiety, and even drug addiction. And because of that, it's now gained even more interest for the students because, of course, it has to do with both fascinating effects in the brain and also potentially some therapeutic effects in the brain.
And we do have a researcher from Johns Hopkins that will be joining us a little bit later on. And I do want to ask you a little bit more about the course that you're teaching. You teach a course on psychoactive drugs. Can you tell us a little bit about how it got started and how it ended up being this course that you've been teaching for almost two decades?
A pharmacologist who had always studied how these drugs work in the brain, and I began the course a long time ago. He was interested in the topic, and I was interested from the point of view of mental illness and antidepressants, antimanics, antipsychotic drugs. So with his interest in how drugs work in the brain and my interest in mental illness, we put the course together, and we always tell students, if we can't make psychoactive drugs interesting, we're not very good teachers.
And how do you make it interesting? Do you give samples?
we don't have a laboratory component of the course, if that's what you're asking. It's just that especially young people come to college with typically have sort of a magical attitude about psychoactive drugs. They tend to think these things sort of have their actions apart from the chemistry of the brain, which of course they can't. And it's useful for them to learn about what's really going on in the brain when we take these kinds of drugs and to disabuse them of the notion that it's all sort of like recreational stuff, because a lot of things happen in the brain with a lot of these drugs that are not very pretty.
Yeah, I think that sometimes we don't think about possibly the negative effects. In your experience of teaching this course, have you found that more people are becoming interested or more positive as time goes by and we're hearing more studies that are being put out?
They are. Students are sort of following what you'd expect to be reading in the papers. So, for example, our students we always take a poll. Should we legalize marijuana in Indiana? And the students are running far more accepting of that than the national average population, but it's never 100%. We've got students that say, no, I think it's a bad idea. But otherwise, they are often just we all hear about the opioid epidemic. No one, unless you take a course like this, ever gets into the science of what's happening with opioids, why we have such a problem, which is, of course, the epidemic has to do with a lot of social, cultural, you know, economic factors, but how the drugs work in the brain to cause addiction and to cause respiratory depression and be fatal in overdose are topics that students need to learn about and often don't know a whole lot about.
That's an interesting point. And just to go off on a tangent a little bit about opioids, do you think they're in the same level of psychedelics in terms of how society looks at them? Or because you can get opioids through a prescription, but it seems like they're pretty bad.
Yes, there's a totally different animal because the opioids have wonderful properties in terms of pain relief primarily, but they have all these terrible problems. These psychedelics are safe in overdose. The psychedelics are basically non-toxic. They can cause what's called behavioral toxicity. They may make you do something that's very stupid and maybe even dangerous, but in terms of the chemistry of the drug, they're completely safe, and the opioids are very, very unsafe. And so in terms of if it's misused, put it that way, opioids, of course, are highly effective and widely used in safe manner by many people, by most people.
So I guess I'm trying to understand here. So if someone were taking opioids, there's a chance of a side effect of something like depressing their system and if they took too much, whereas if you were taking a psychedelic, you might just be a little bit out of your mind for a while.
That's basically right. The opioids, if you take an overdose of opioids, you will stop breathing and you will die. If you take a lot of an LSD, you may have a bad so-called trip, a bad experience, but it's not going to stop your breathing or your heart or any other physical problems will result from it.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope students will learn from the course that you're teaching?
I want them to learn that these things are scientifically understandable and that they need to be looked at and analyzed from that perspective, that public policy is often not very closely correlated with the science, that, for example, we've got new laws in the states that have legalized marijuana for standards of driving while intoxicated with marijuana, driving while stoned. And one of the points we want to make to the class is it's not as easy to measure that and to enforce that law in a fair way as it is for alcohol, because the blood alcohol levels tell us about driving incompetence, if you will. If they're high enough, we know a person can't drive safely. We have lots of data to say the blood alcohol of this equals this kind of problem, and we can make a reasonable statute. But if we're talking about marijuana, then the amounts can't be measured easily. The effects of the blood, if you try to correlate the effects that it has on driving as a function of blood levels, that's not very clear. It's a much, much muddier picture. And for the students to realize that these kinds of things need to be understood is the main goal of the course.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break, and we'll continue our conversation with Bruce Martin, professor of anatomy, cell biology, and physiology at Indiana University. We'll also be joined a little bit later in the segment by a professor who's been studying the effects of psychedelics on people. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're continuing our conversation with Bruce Martin, professor of anatomy, cell biology, and physiology at Indiana University on psychedelics. Bruce teaches a course at Indiana University called the Medical Science of Psychoactive Drugs. Bruce, have you ever received pushback for the course, of fears that making things sound less scary could encourage people to try drugs?
Well, I think as I was telling someone that we had one time, an incoming class, and the parents came to the first day, and one of the fathers was obviously concerned that I was teaching the class in order to maybe brainwash the kids into wanting to use drugs. But the feedback I get is very clear, which is you take this course and you'll never want to use drugs, because we don't shy away from the fact that these drugs can be very, very, very dangerous, especially things like methamphetamine and cocaine and opioids and overdose, and we talk about all the liver diseases that come from alcohol abuse and overuse, so that we have an effect, I think, mostly of discouraging use rather than encouraging use.
Well, I have to say, when I was looking you up and researching your background, I saw that you're involved with a psychedelic club. So my first impression was, oh, this guy's really into this stuff. So can you tell me about the club and what its role is?
The Psychedelic Club is something the students started, and they need a faculty sponsor, and I am serving as that person. And the bylaws of the club are that nobody does anything illegal. And the activities of the club are set and run by the students. And as I look at what they do, and I don't personally participate, I'm obviously overseeing, make sure that something is not right is going on. And nothing is – they do things like read books that have to do with history of psychedelics, maybe with somebody who's experienced them. There's some national psychedelic club activities where they'll get a researcher on who will talk about what's going on, something like what you have on your show right now. And they will have activities where people will – they'll have a kava ceremony or a cacao ceremony using a legal drug that has perhaps some slight psychedelic actions. They'll meet and – you know, do artistic things together and so forth. So it's a club for people that want to learn about this in lots of different dimensions. So there's the heavy science side, there's more the cultural side, there's more the experiential side in terms of the minor safe things that might be available out there. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sort of there making sure that everything's okay.
So they'd probably get together and have like 3-4 shots of espresso and paint a picture.
That's basically what it's like in many cases, yes. And the student leadership we've had has been very good, very creative, have done a lot of interesting things. And there are a couple of hundred club members, so there's a lot of activity going on.
I want to talk a little bit about where Indiana stands. Are you aware of any laws or research being done in our state?
I'm not aware of any state-specific things at all, except, of course, we all know about which states have and which states have not legalized marijuana at this point.
Right. Like our next door neighbors in Illinois seem to be doing quite well with their marijuana business. but Indiana, do you think Indiana will ever make its way down that path, or even like I even think about like psychedelic drugs. If marijuana isn't legalized, I wonder if there's even a path for things like psilocybin.
It's interesting. Oregon, of course, is leading the way on some of this legalization, and Portugal as a nation has decriminalized almost all drugs. And these are issues that are obviously complex on many levels. And it's interesting for me, we do these pollings of the students, and as marijuana has become legalized in nearby states, some of the students are saying, I've been to these states and I don't like it that well. I'm a little uncomfortable with all the easy access to these drugs. So it's not a unidimensional, one-directional drive towards everything is going to be more and more liberalized. I don't think it's that clear, but I have no predictions myself.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is next in this realm, or what are you planning next for your course?
Well, the thing I'm looking forward to the most is to see how these studies of psilocybin and the treatment of mental illness and drug addiction come along. I was reading this yesterday. There are 76 clinical trials currently using psilocybin and studying its effects on a variety of mostly depression, anxiety, and so forth. And I'm very curious to see how that turns out. I'm very hopeful. And I know a psychiatrist up in Carmel who says this is the next big thing, and I'm hoping he's correct.
Thank you so much, Bruce Martin, professor of anatomy, cell biology, and physiology at Indiana University. With us now as we move on to discuss the application of psychedelic drugs is Matthew Johnson, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. If you have questions about psychedelics, you want some answers, our phone lines are open. You can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881 or let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. Welcome, Matthew.
Hi, happy to be here.
Matthew, you're one of the most published scientists on the human effects of psychedelics. How did you go down this path and end up in this field?
Well, as a college student, I became fascinated by this area of psychoactive drugs in general, be it anything from caffeine to alcohol to the illicit drugs, the effects that these had on brain and behavior. And so I became very fascinated by just the science of drugs in general. But then within that context, I was learning more about the world and the history of these psychedelics, and including their history in science. But just from a larger cultural perspective, really came to the conclusion, if you're interested in drugs that affect the mind and behavior, then you've got to be fascinated with the psychedelics, because they're the ultimate example of that. I mean, what other drug class do you see where someone says that they, tried it one time and they had, this experience that positively shaped their life for decades to come? I mean, that doesn't always happen, but it sometimes does happen, especially in the clinic, under the right conditions with psychedelics, which is just absolutely fascinating.
What is it about psychedelics in particular that fascinates you?
Well, it's just that their potential for behavior change. And within, there's lots of angles, but within treatment, I the prospect that you can have a psychiatric medication that can really prompt something that can look more like a cure. And I'm not saying it always does and it's right for everybody, but an astonishingly high number of times with these various disorders that we've studied, it really seems that people get to the psychological roots of their issues. They process, their self-doubts, their narrowed view of the world, whether it's within an addiction or whether it's depression or how they're dealing with with cancer, and they just come away with a much broader perspective that they value and hold on to. And that's different than the symptom relief of, you know, the typical medication you take on a daily basis. You need to keep taking it because it's not really solving the problem, even though those are important tools to have, don't get me wrong. But as another option in the toolbox, psychedelics offer something completely different.
Would it be fair to say that psychedelics access a part of your brain that maybe we just don't tap into regularly?
Yeah, something like that. I wouldn't, you know, the science nerd in me starts to get squeamish when you say it's not actually a part of your brain, but it gets the brain in a mode of operation. I would definitely say this, a mode of operation that can be really beneficial acutely. The brain enters, and this is consistent with animal work that's unfolding, showing across multiple labs now, showing different forms of neuroplasticity unfolding after a psychedelic has been administered. So the growth of the branches on the neurons, the dendrites, the formation of new connections between different neurons, these synaptogenesis, the creation of new synapses. So these different forms of neuroplasticity are shown to unfold after the administration of a psychedelic in a rat. We don't know if that's what's happening in the human therapeutic use. My bet is that is a part of what's unfolding. That combined with just this experience that they can literally learn from, the way one can learn from an everyday life experience.
Are there common myths that surround psychedelics that aren't true? I'm sure there are probably tons of things. I remember hearing as a kid something about licking stamps was dangerous because it could have LSD. I don't even know what LSD is aside from something scary now. So can you take us through some of this?
Yeah, there's so many of them. One early on, they what they call chromosome damage, based on some just a couple of a research finding in the late 60s that was squarely put in context within a year or two later. It broke up, LSD broke up chromosomes in a petri dish. Well, a lot of things we take like aspirin and caffeine will do that too, apparently. And it wasn't shown to have any sort of genetic, you know, effects on people in terms of, you know, risk their offspring, this type of thing. So that's one of them. You know, the idea that people have stared into the sun while they're on psychedelics and burnt their, you know, vision out, that has not happened. You know, just an urban legend. There's a lot of, you know, I don't know. I heard when I was in high school that if you took LSD seven times, you were legally considered insane and not allowed to testify in court. I have never come across any evidence that anything like that was close to true. But there is a kernel of truth to some of these things. Like, you know, I would say it's sort of a myth that it's routine for people to be compelled to jump out of a window. But has it happened? Yes. Like with any other highly intoxicating drug, including alcohol, you know, sometimes a dangerous environment and being on a highly intoxicating, reality altering compound, you know, don't mix. And so there are examples where people have panicked, they've done something stupid, or they've done something like, you know, gone out of a window. Again, it's not typical, but there's a kernel of truth there of, you know, these cases where there are accidents and sometimes fatal accidents that happen when someone's on a psychedelic.
Does this relate to historical events? I can't think of any off the top of my head, but where, or even in stories where people, quote unquote, went insane, but maybe they were just on something.
Yeah. There's a well sort of recognized theory that some of the cases of insanity or you know, the outbreaks of things such as, well, the Salem witch trials, the idea that a chemical relative of LSD was in the grain that they were growing. We know that LSD was actually synthesized from ergot, a fungus that grows on grain that can have poisonous as well as hallucinogenic effects. And it can also be potentially deadly, but that things like this that tainted grain throughout history may have caused psychedelic experiences. There's also some not conclusive but credible evidence suggestive that this type of ergot derivative may have been at the heart of the mysteries of Eleusis in ancient Greece, that a religion that spanned for thousands of years. And they talked about taking this secret and sacred concoction once a year after making this, you know, a pilgrimage outside of Athens. And so a compelling history there as well.
As you're saying this, it's making me wonder if stories of people with superpowers or things like that, if it's somehow rooted in some of this through history, just these experiences.
Yeah, well, that you know, perhaps we do know that in many cultures, something like a shaman, and it differs across cultures, but there often is a role like this, that person might be the, I don't know, the prototype for the superhero. In a sense, they talk about traveling to different worlds, like the spirit world, this type of thing, communicating with the dead, you know, superpowers of a sort. And not in every society, but in a good number of societies, one of the tools of these shaman were psychedelic drugs to allow them to, you know, supposedly, you know, do these things like travel in the spirit world and commune with the dead, or even, you know, scope out what the neighboring tribe is going to do in their war against them.
We have a listener voicemail from Rosemary who has a question about a specific kind of treatment. Let's take a listen.
Hi, my name is Rosemary. I'm calling from Indianapolis, and I was calling. My son has severe mental illness and has recently gone through ketamine infusion therapy. He has had unbelievable results, and I'd be curious if your expert has experience or information on that kind of treatment. Thanks.
Yeah, ketamine is it's an interesting compound. It's been used in medicine for decades and decades because it's a general anesthetic. It's what's used to one of the things used to put people to sleep, and it's very good at that. So it's been improved in medicine a long time, but over the last couple of decades, the research slowly grew, showing that ketamine was effective for depression, and it was approved a couple of years ago by under the one form of it, Spravato, which is S-ketamine, was approved. The interesting thing about ketamine is that, first, its results are quite impressive in the sense that compared to all of the traditional antidepressants, the effects are immediate. They don't take several weeks to a month to kick in. So the effects are immediate, and they're pretty persisting. In other words, on average, the research shows that that treatment will an infusion of ketamine will have antidepressant effects for about a week, sometimes a week or two, which is still better than treatment once a day. There's also, with a typical, you know, antidepressant pill, there's some older research and some early modern research that's used ketamine more in the style of psychedelic therapy for the treatment of addiction. And what I mean by psychedelic therapy is the current use of ketamine is typically telling the standard practice is to tell people, yes, you'll feel a little different when the drug is acting. Ignore that. Those are side effects. You know, this is going to just get through it. But the effects in your brain will make you feel better. Psychedelic therapy, on the other hand, tells the person you're going to have a very different experience. We want you to be prepared for that. And we want you to explore, see it as a exploration of your mind and see if you can learn something from it. And in the days following, we're going to talk about it and see if we can help you, you know, pull some lessons from it that can inform, you know, the problems whatever problems you're having in life. So, you know, I suspect actually that using ketamine more like a psychedelic by telling people to focus on the experience and to process the experience, that you get more mileage from it, even with, in the treatment of depression. And some clinics are using it in that way. And it can also be given off-label besides Spravato and by injection and by other routes. But and it's also being explored for other, you know, for bipolar and other, I think it, other disorders. It shows a lot of promise and is certainly related to the research we're doing with the other psychedelics like psilocybin.
I do want to talk a little bit more about some of the research that you've done. After a quick break, we will continue our conversation on psychedelics and the future of medicine with Matthew Johnson, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. If you have any questions or comments for our guest today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. Can you take us through what it is like when you're administering this psilocybin to someone and they go through this experience? My understanding is that they go on something called a trip. I've never done this or been around anyone who does this, so I have no clue what I'm talking about. But I've heard stories that people go on a journey or something. And I would like to know, what is that?
Yeah, so the setting is one where they're encouraged to lay on a couch and wear eye shades and wear headphones through which music is played. That's already been selected, so they're not playing DJ during it. But so this is a very introspective framework. You know, a lot of people that use these things for fun often are, you know, just walking around. They're at a concert. They're in the forest. You know, they're chatting with their friends. The idea here is to sort of really magnify the psychological effects, the really personal psychological effects by focusing the attention inward. So that's what, you know, really the eye shades are about, and the idea they're just sort of like paying attention to their experience. So they really, you know, do go in a sense on a mental journey. I mean, you can use lots of analogies, but folks liken it to really an exploration of their mind but that can be the full, the full gamut. I mean, you have the, you know, realms of experience of love and beauty beyond words, and then you have absolutely, you know, soul crushing reality, you know, distorting or reality, you know, sort of vanishing, you know, sort of experiences where people can get into what's called ego death, where they really feel that they're, you know, whatever they are is deconstructing and that they're in a sense dying. And this can be a difficult experience, anxiety provoking experience. We find that those types of experiences are well handled, even if they're not fun, but they haven't caused any long-term damage in this context. It sometimes does out in the wild, so to speak. But often people learn from even those difficult experiences and come to value them. So it's a, you know, you prepare the people and they're with someone that they trust, with two people that they've spent several hours, you know, developing a therapeutic relationship with. So they're only interacting with people they trust. They're kind of going inward and they're told to embrace whatever the experience is, you know, just, you know, don't overanalyze it. Just, you know, collect experiences. If you feel like crying, you know, cry. If you feel like laughing, laugh, you know, go with the experience, and you know, trust, let go, and be open is sort of the mission statement we give them.
Mm-hmm. It just sounds to me, letting go sounds so scary, because I just think of folks in the medical field who talk about, like, when they put people under anesthesia and they just start saying crazy stuff when they come out of it. I'm like, I don't know that I would want to be in that kind of a situation. Is that similar?
Yeah. And if someone really has concerns about, maybe not wanting to talk about something, whatever, in their past, or, you know, then that's part of the consent process. We tell them, like, this is not, you know, then this isn't the study for you, because it really, we can't guarantee you what, I mean, we may be treating smoking, you know, cessation, helping you quit smoking, but, you know, we've had people in that line of research that, you know, all of a sudden some trauma, you know, from 40 years ago comes up as, I mean, and that takes center stage, and you may not want to do that. You may not want to reprocess. And in this particular case I'm thinking of, a 40-year-old, you know, spousal abuse trauma, it was, you know, very successfully resolved and so very valuable. But if you're not, you know, it's not like you can control the thing, like, oh, I'm here to quit smoking, or I'm here for that, you know, to learn this or that. It's like, one, clinically, the best description is that folks say they, one just needs to surrender to the experience. It is what it's going to be, and don't try to guide it. Don't try to, you know, force it to give you the answers that you think you want to get. So that's why this orientation of and we use a dose that really is overwhelming. It really can't be controlled in the sense that, and that's part of the point that of this therapy, that one has these overwhelming psychological experiences that are sort of bigger than life, that they can, from which they can be, have a different vantage point on their life that they can hold on to. So it's it kind of comes with this risk of that, of it can be scary. You know, it's like strapping oneself into a roller coaster, except actually, you know, you can't even really see the roller coaster before you go on. You know, it's like you could go places you don't know.
That's sounding scarier and scarier to me. But in general, I mean, so you talked about that there are some risks here. Do you think right now this topic is being sensationalized or turned into something that it's not, and that there is a dark side to it?
Oh, there's definitely a dark side to it, but that's the problem. There's a lot going on. There is truly extremely promising, you know. I don't think it's sensationalistic to say I think this could be paradigm shifting in psychiatry. It's not going to be used to treat everyone. It's not going to be, it's not going to work for everyone. But I do think that it could be a substantial advancement, like a major other area, a major other form of treatment modality that sort of combines the best of psychotherapy in a more rapid, accelerated process that, you know, medications typically don't give you. So I think there's a whole, and so far the sizes of these improvements that I've been describing are statistically and clinically very large. So, you know, you want to be clear about that. Hey folks, you know, this is really promising. We need to invest more in this research. We need to get more scientists interested in this research. On the other hand, there is a dark side. And I've published a lot on this on people. Sometimes people are harmed or killed from psychedelic experiences in uncontrolled settings, or maybe due to some vulnerability that, you know, the type of thing that we screen out when we carefully, you know, vet people for our medical, you know, research. So, and there are people that use this in a nefarious way. I mean, the most notorious case is Charles Manson used LSD as one of his ways of essentially brainwashing his cult followers, which he, brainwashed him into this, you know, crazy race war theory, and that led to the, you know, murders of multiple innocent people that, you know, became at the time the world's most, you know, famous, you know, crime case. But it really, that it also made it salient for people in the public, because this was in 1969, at sort of the end of the 60s, literally. And, you know, that, hey, there is a dark side to this. And then it was uncovered that the CIA had been using LSD and other psychedelics really nefariously, like giving unsuspecting American citizens doses of LSD to study their effects so that they could potentially use it as a weapon, an interrogation agent, or an agent, a battlefield agent of some type. So there is a dark side and some dark research and some dark uses of it. And a lot of would-be sort of, you know, gurus out there who we should be really suspicious of, who particularly when, as if this, and it probably will, if the data continue, be approved as medicine, we have to really pay attention to how this is used, and it's and that it not in its medical use not fall into the hands of would be cult leaders, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking too, just like how in some states now that marijuana is legalized, it's become like a big business. If something like this were to become a business environment, I mean, are there going to be regulations?
Well, see, that's the nice thing about the path that the psychedelics are following. It's this FDA path that would potentially lead to medical approval, which, you know, doesn't rely on any sort of state level changes. It's not like, you know, if if psilocybin is approved for the treatment of depression and cigarette addiction, that does not mean that it's going to be that, you know, Denver can open up a bunch of shops like, you know, there are for cannabis. So, you know, it would be through the completely federal, you know, medical pathway by which it would be approved. Now, some states and cities are doing some other things like decriminalizing or even in one case in Oregon, legalizing. But you know, the potential medical path approval by the FDA does not depend on those local changes.
I do wonder, as a researcher, how are you able to secure these substances that are considered illegal?
So there's a pathway. I mean, they're controlled substances, so they're not illegal in all contexts. So it's always been possible to do research with controlled substances. And I've done research with, you know, cocaine, methamphetamine, all kinds of sedative compounds, all kinds of controlled substances. There's a lot of red tape, basically. You got to get approval from, you know, your local, your university, which is the Institutional Review Board, so-called IRBs. So you got to get that. You got to get approval from the FDA. You submit an investigational new drug application, which is how it goes through the FDA. And the FDA has to approve your research. And then the DEA has to, you have to be registered with the DEA and jump through the hoops there. But, you know, they follow, you know, it takes a while and the system could be improved. But, you know, if you stick with it, you know, there's a path forward to do this work.
What are you most hopeful about that you've seen so far in your research?
Treating addiction. So I think that just really needs to be expanded. I think we can potentially have just a very, very powerful tool in treating addiction. But, you know, we're still early in the research and we need to follow up with. And the exciting thing there is that it early research suggests it's not just for one, you know, addiction to tobacco or alcohol or cocaine. There's a potential signal there across all these, the real psychological roots of addiction that, you know, don't depend on the surface level drug or the particular withdrawal symptoms you get for that particular drug. It's the commonalities, that psychological struggle that really is the heart of addiction that this seems to address. So I think there's a incredible potential to learn about and to treat addiction using these compounds.
We have about 2 minutes left. I was wondering if you have any thoughts for audience, for the listeners who might be thinking, oh, this sounds promising. Maybe I'm going to give it a whirl. Why is it important for folks to be in a controlled environment as you know, in addition to it not being legal, but why is that important?
Well, you know, there is not, you know, it's not legal. So there is some risk, you know, there. There's also a number of risks that we know about, but we control, we address in our studies and in potential, you know, medical work if it were approved outside of research. But there's some evidence that people with a predisposition to psychotic disorders like schizophrenia could have a lasting adverse effect from these compounds. People at a very high level of heart disease, even though they're robustly safe for most people at the bodily level, they do modestly raise your blood pressure and pulse. So the type of people that could have a stroke from going up a couple flights of stairs, well, this could be a risk for them too. And there's a risk of a bad trip. Anyone, of regardless of vulnerability, could really have a strong anxiety, fear, confusion reaction, and basically freak out. The real harm ultimately comes from typically people, their reaction to it. You know, they end up running across, traffic and get hit by a car, or they end up in a scuffle with the authorities, that type of thing. And it sort of, you know, snowballs out of where it started. So there are risks. So I don't want people to let the research encourage their own use. You know, that said, if someone's going to use, I don't encourage it, but I do want people to be aware of what the riskiest use is when people use by themselves, not knowing what they're taking, you know, not knowing what dose they're taking. And that's certainly a riskier form of use than, you know, even if it's illicit, using with someone watching them, knowing what dose they're taking, et cetera.
Well, thank you so much, Matthew Johnson, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.